Dr. Hermeet Malik is a geneticist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, where he studies the coevolution of humans and diseases. He was recently awarded the Vilcek Prize for Creative Promise in Biomedical Science for his work in the study of the genetic history of ancient viruses, paleovirology. He was also awarded the Presidential Early Career Award in Science and Engineering, and I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Malik to our show today. Hello.
Hello, very nice to be here.
You've called your work the study of the evolutionary arms race. What do you mean by that?
Well, at any given point, we are sort of constantly facing a barrage of different types of infectious agents trying to take over as they're prone to. And our immune system is constantly battling them off. And we refer to these as arms races because at any given point, one entity, either the virus or the host, is losing this sort of high-stakes battle. And because of that, there's always going to be evolutionary pressure for one or the other agent to adapt.
Well, that's something that I understood instinctively. What I didn't understand is that we have the traces of those battles going back millions of years in all of our bodies.
Yeah, so that's a really unique perspective afforded to us by agents like retroviruses who, as an obligate form of their life cycle, leave an imprint in the host genome that they infect. So for us, these provide a great fossil record of these past infections that the retroviruses that integrated millions of years ago presumably lost their battles with the host genome, essentially provide us with a very nice record of all the retroviruses that were encountered by these hosts.
I think the first time I heard the word retrovirus was when HIV/AIDS came into the public consciousness. How is a retrovirus different from a regular virus?
So the retrovirus has a couple of very unique features. One of them is the enzyme reverse transcriptase, where the genome of the retrovirus is basically transmitted through RNA, and that's actually converted to DNA, which then goes in and integrates into the host DNA. As a result, the host DNA now carries an imprint of that retrovirus.
And then that becomes part of our genome. And then when we have children, we pass that or some of that on to our children.
That's exactly right.
Paleovirology is looking into all of this. How old is this science?
Well, I think the term paleovirology is only a few years old, but the science into paleovirology really got a huge boost by the sequencing of the human genome, because when the human genome was sequenced, it was quite a bit of a shock to a lot of scientists. I would say that less than 5% of the genome, at that point it was believed less than 1% of the genome, actually encoded something that was we would consider, quote, human DNA, with human genes, all the genes that make up the proteins in the cell. Whereas 8% of the human genome was made up of these fossilized viruses that we have been accumulating.
Well, how do you even spot them?
So you can actually spot them because the decay rate of these viruses is slow enough that we can actually match them up using bioinformatics to current-day viruses. And so we know what types of patterns we are looking for and use them to search the DNA sequence.
Are they totally inert in our systems now? Have they been totally... have all of the threat been taken from them, or is there a possibility that they can be reactivated?
In the human genome, there is no active endogenous retrovirus. But the last burst of activity in the human genome was relatively recent in evolutionary timeframes, which means in the last million years or so, there was a huge burst of activity. But as it sits in the human genome, there is no retrovirus that's capable of full function. Now, that's not to say that so there are three genes encoded by these retroviruses. One makes up the capsid, one encodes all the enzymes, and one provides the infectious ability. You could imagine a Frankenstein virus being put together where two genes might come in from one, dead virus, and the third gene comes in from another dead virus, essentially reconstituting it. That probability is extremely unlikely, though, because those events would have to occur in the same cell.
But we are, to some degree, like a geological record here. We have all of these fossils in us, and they're not doing anything. They're just there. They're taking up space.
They're taking up space. I mean, in a way, they're sort of degenerating with mutation over time, very much like if you have a huge house where you're a couple who only lives in the living room and your master bedroom, those are the only rooms you travel in, and there's no dusting happening in the other rooms, including the attic. And they start accumulating cobwebs and dust. And essentially, that's what 90% of the genome is doing, is just accumulating mutations. As a result, these viruses can persist there, and they're basically showing signs of those mutations.
Is there any benefit from having them there?
So that's a great question. It turns out that very much like sort of all forms of mutation, in some instances, the genes encoded by these viruses could be of use to humans. So for instance, there's a very interesting gene called syncytin that was discovered recently by a number of groups, which is actually only expressed in the placenta. It turns out that the human placenta is a hotbed of one type of activity, which is cell-cell fusion, where nutrients from mom need to be transmitted to the baby. Now, there's one type of gene that's really great at cell-cell fusion, and that's the retroviruses envelope gene, because that's the property it uses to infect cells. It turns out that the syncytin gene is itself a paleoviral remnant of a virus that entered primate genomes about 35 million years ago. Now, the rest of the retrovirus has completely gone extinct, but this gene has been preserved because it was retained by the primate genomes since it conferred this activity that allowed the placenta to carry out this function.
So some of these things have just become part of the normal human genome, and we don't even think of them as anything like a retrovirus. We just think of them as part of what we are.
Exactly. This is now a human gene.
Obviously, when we look back at all of this record, we learn something about how we have evolved.
That's what groups like mine are very interested in, which is how has the sort of constant battle over evolutionary time shaped the repertoire of antiviral genes that we host today? So we are very interested in recent events. For instance, chimpanzees and gorillas are chock full of a retrovirus called PTERV, which infected both species about 4 million years ago, but no imprints at all in the human genome. We are very interested in why the human genome was protected and whether this was a genetic protection. And some work that we've published on has shown that actually changes in a very important antiviral gene that allowed protection against PTERV may have actually unwittingly led to susceptibility to HIV.
I'm sure that you've had contact with creationists. How do you discuss all of this with them?
Well, in a way, the fossil record provided by endogenous retroviruses is the biggest argument against creationism, which is these retroviruses, let's say a retrovirus that entered 80 million years ago into the common ancestor of all primates. Now, this virus is actually present in all primate genomes in exactly the same location. And the probability that this did not happen by common descent becomes diminishingly small with every sort of passing species.
I'm speaking with Dr. Hermit Mullick, who is a geneticist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, where he studies the coevolution of humans and diseases. What are transposons? Because I understand that they are really important, an early interest of yours and something that helped launch your career.
So simply put, transposons are jumping genes. And when I was looking around for what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, I just got very interested in the notion that large parts of our genomes were sort of mobile and mercenaries, if you will, individual genes that were just interested in transmitting themselves, unlike, you know, the genes that make up most of the human cell.
Retrotransposons. They've been called selfish genes?
That's right. So there are two flavors of transposons. In the human genome, there's only retrotransposons. Other genomes have both DNA and retrotransposons. Now, retrotransposons are really interesting because they've never had an infectious lifestyle. They've never crossed species, etc., except they still make up at least 50% of our DNA. So when you contrast that with the fact that only 2% of our DNA is human, 8% is virus, and 50% is made up of these genomic mercenaries called retrotransposons, it becomes sort of clear that we're really carrying a large sort of history of these battles with old retrotransposons.
And you said that we're carrying a history of our ancestors, even pre-human ancestors here. Does that, for example, HIV/AIDS has been linked to apes. Would that history go all the way back to before we were humans, or does it make us susceptible to HIV/AIDS today and not at another time?
So the HIV virus, the form we know it today is actually fairly young. We know that it crossed into the human species during the last 150 years. And we have a pretty good idea about the source virus from chimpanzees that it crossed into.
So, but it didn't affect the chimpanzees?
So recent reports suggest that it has caused effects in the chimpanzees, except the disease is less severe for sure in the chimpanzees. And what we are trying to understand, and a lot of groups are trying to understand, is what is the genetic difference between the chimpanzee and the human antiviral repertoire that allows humans to be more susceptible compared to chimpanzees.
And would that be a part of the research into helping us understand how we could survive HIV?
That's precisely right. So the goal of paleovirology is the lessons we learn from defeating these old viruses that we've undoubtedly defeated will help us guide into new antiviral regimens.
In looking at the genomes of chimps or any kind of apes, does the record of their exposure remain in their genome?
That's right. So the mammalian genomes are actually really poor at housekeeping, you could say. So in a fruit fly genome, which is another organism we study, a retrotransposon insertion would be stable for less than a million years. In the human genome, something could survive unscathed for over 100 million years. It's acquiring mutations, but not enough to obliterate its existence.
But this process, you're saying, occurs in all living beings.
That's correct.
So anything that has been attacked by a virus will retain certain record of that virus throughout the millennia?
Anything in which the virus has actually ended up making an imprint in the germ line, so the cells that lead to the sperm and the egg, so now that becomes part of the genetic heritage.
Now, your lab is at a cancer center. Does your work have an application to the study of cancer?
So my lab studies a number of things, but recent evidence has shown that a number of viruses actually are the underlying etiological agents for cancers. A great example is the human papillomavirus. And so I'm in the basic sciences division where we are looking at a number of these hypothetical viruses as sources to explain a number of cancers. We are particularly interested in some lymphomas.
It is interesting that when we first started talking about cancer, we thought they were all the same. But some have a viral source, some don't.
So it seems
all they have in common is that the cells go crazy and start reproducing.
Each cancer requires multiple hits. In some instances, that those two hits could be genetic. So you could have some genetic susceptibility and you acquire a mutation. In other instances, you could have a genetic susceptibility and now you get a bacterial or a viral infection that now acts as a second hit. And so we're very interested in both of those are agents of mutation.
When you're looking at these extinct viruses in your lab, you're just looking at them in terms of photographs, aren't you? Is there a possibility that you could ever resurrect them?
So we have successfully resurrected one retrovirus, the one that I was talking about from chimpanzees, because we were very interested in asking the question, why were human cells not infected by this beta retrovirus, given that it had the opportunity? And so recent science and developments in synthetic biology allow us to recreate not just the sequence of the virus, but even individual viral genes.
But that sounds to me like the stuff of science fiction. There's always the fear that you bring back some old ancient virus, and then it reemerges as a threat to humans.
It's a real concern, but there's a lot of safeguards that we put. For instance, the viruses that we test are tested in a form where they would not be capable of mounting more than one round of infection. So they go into one cell and that's it. They just don't carry the genes required for their transmission with them, which is a really great way of ensuring that they will never be transmitted from one cell to another.
When you first started looking for funding for this sort of thing, did you find it hard to explain all of this to potential funders?
In the beginning, people weren't convinced that an evolutionary look at these arms races would reveal anything interesting. But what we've realized as we published our first few studies is that the lessons we learned from our sort of primate ancestors are directly relevant to how humans are differentially susceptible to disease. And that has allowed the funding gates to at least be slightly pried open.
We've been talking recently to some of the researchers trying to come up with vaccines for HIV, but they've all been attacking the retrovirus as it exists, the envelope and the way that it mutates, et cetera, et cetera. Well, could this also be aid them in their research?
I think it's an excellent question, Leonard. I think what this approach allows you to do is actually identify host genes that the virus absolutely depends on for its infection. A great example is the CCR5 gene, where people who are naturally mutant for CCR5 are much less susceptible to HIV.
Or leukemia for some reason.
Exactly. And so in some instances, we want to identify host genes that the virus is crucially dependent on, but which are not essential for the host. And attacking those might be a much better strategy in terms of drug regimens that would work against the virus.
But I've wondered why CCR5 is leukemia and HIV. They don't seem to have much in common.
So the leukemia results are fairly new and being tested, but there seems to be a clear connection, at least in terms of Yersinia pestis infection, which was sort of a close relative of the bacteria that caused the Black Plague. So it seems that these are both a bacterial and a viral gateway to the cell.
Can we find traces of the Black Plague in the human genome?
Unfortunately, since the Black Plague does not integrate into the human genome, we're sort of left with a very spotty record, which is very abundant in retroviruses, but not at all present in the case of bacteria.
The Vilcek Prize that you won is given to people who weren't born in the United States. I'm assuming you were born in the Punjab.
I was actually born in Mumbai, India.
In Mumbai?
Yeah.
And what brought you to the United States?
I came to the United States for graduate studies in evolutionary biology. I thought this was a really... I was trained as a chemical engineer, and it was easier, and I had more opportunities to explore my interests here.
And could you have done this kind of research in India? India is becoming rather sophisticated scientifically.
I think it would be possible to do this research in India or sort of anywhere in the world. The environment at the Fred Hutchinson is really fantastic for this kind of research because I'm trained as an evolutionary biologist and I collaborate with a virologist, and we are completely equal partners in this enterprise. And it really requires this multidisciplinary approach to make deep insights.
Do you find that students discovering that there is this new field are getting all excited about it? Is there much work still to be done?
There's a lot of work to be done. Just last week, in fact, it was discovered that even though we consider only retroviruses as being part of, host genomes, there are a number of Ebola-like viruses that have been present in mammalian genomes. And 2 months ago, the report that Borna viruses, which are sort of believed to be very, very rare, are actually present in human genomes and present in many primate genomes, and actually might have some genes that are still active, like the syncytin gene that I was talking about earlier.
Well, we've been talking about the primate record, but do some of these ancient viruses and retroviruses predate when we were primates?
The retroviruses certainly do. I mean, one of the things that the paleo...
How far back do we go? To jellyfish?
Earlier than that, even. I mean, some of these, for instance, retrotransposons date back to the common ancestor of all eukaryotes, which is more than a billion years old.
So this is what links all living creatures in a way.
This
we
is
all
part
have
of
certain
the common
things
ancestor.
In common. And not just the sorts of things that promote life, but also things that we just overcame in the past that remain in our bodies.
That's right.
It's kind of shocking, isn't it? I find.
Well, I think it's a really good reminder of the unity of life in the sense that we have cells, and cells provide a machinery which is always prone to being hijacked by a selfish gene or a selfish element, and these. Retrotransposons have been really fantastically successful at taking advantage of unsuspecting host genomes.
Well, so what is your latest research looking into?
So the latest research we're looking into is recognizing that given that we have faced these arms races, so far we've been looking at dedicated antiviral genes, but now we've begun to look at host genes that are not necessarily perceived as antiviral, but which the virus really needs as part of its life cycle.
Dr. Hermit Mullick is a geneticist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. I want to congratulate him for winning both the Vilcek Prize and also the Presidential Early Career Award in Science and Engineering. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you today. And I'm always learning stuff, but I learned an awful lot this time.
Thank you very much, Leonard. It's a pleasure to be here.